Welcome to Coffee Calm Connections Podcasts with your hosts, Sarah and Stuart. You'll hear from people like us, people like you, and together we'll find ways to make personal development easier and more accessible. Hello, Stuart. Welcome back to Coffee Calm Connections Podcast. What, a year and a bit on since the last episode, is that right?
Absolutely, and what a year it's been. You've had an incredibly interesting year. We've spoken a bit, but I'd love to hear the story of what actually happened and where you are now. Are you willing to take me back to the beginning?
I certainly am. Challenging, shit, interesting, but I think there's been a lot of personal development as well. So, really interesting year. Let's talk about it. Let's talk about the lessons learnt. Maybe you can guide me through some of the lessons I'm still desperately trying to learn. That would be good.
So, the last time, well, the first I heard was I got an email from you on Monday or Tuesday afternoon saying, I'm not going to make our recording later because I've had some kind of stroke. And I thought that was a typo at first, but I gathered it wasn't. Fill me in, what actually happened?
It was the 17th of January, 2022, and I had walked into the office and I'd done my usual kind of brisk walk. And I was trying really hard at that time to do breathing exercises. I was reading a book about the Wim Hof method, and I was trying really hard to do proper meditative breathing and all that kind of stuff. So I walked into the office, it's only 2 miles, got to the office and I was cleaning and I thought I'd make a coffee and I was just having a nice settle into the morning. It was about 10 to 8. And at 8:15, I realised I'd left my bloody laptop at home. So I phoned my husband and I was like, I've got a podcast. It's in 25 minutes. Can you get into the office, please? Bring my laptop in, please. And I was absolutely fine. There was nothing. My husband arrived about 8:45, and again, nothing. We were messing around, laughing and joking, and I felt something in my mouth. And I remember thinking, there's something in my mouth. And I couldn't quite understand what was going on. I just felt a bit like confused with it. And then it's like a tidal wave hit and I felt everything drop and I lost the ability to speak. And I was trying to say to my husband, I'm having a stroke. And he couldn't quite understand what I was saying, but could see that everything had dropped. And his recollection when I asked him later was like my face froze in total fear with half of it dropped, and I sounded well, he couldn't understand what I was saying. So I was on the floor at this point and he was trying to ring an ambulance, but he didn't have any signal. So I've got like vague recollections because he was in and out of consciousness. I was in and out of consciousness, and he was like hanging out the window trying to ring the ambulance. Anyway, an ambulance couldn't get to us. The whole thing was quite complicated. And he ended up, like, firemen's lifting me out the office, carrying me down the stairs. And it was really lucky because there were two people in separate offices that happened to be there at the same time. One guy called Bruce, and he was brilliant and helped Neil carry me down and, like, stood with me while I was on the floor while Neil went to get the car. And as there was another man coming in, and his wife was the A&E coordinator at Colchester, and we weren't able to get an ambulance, so he was brilliant and he phoned his wife and said, someone's coming in, it looks really bad, think it's a stroke, can you get someone ready? So this happened about 8:40. By 9:00 I was in recess in Colchester A&E. So it was a very kind of dramatic moment, and I was conscious but barely. By the time I was in the car, I was a bit more conscious, and I remember saying to my husband, phone my dad, because I work with my dad, phone my dad on the loudspeaker. And I kept trying to say, like, I've got a podcast, I'm late for my podcast, can you tell them that I won't be in the podcast, because it was a podcast for a client that I was hosting. And I just remember being really panicked about that. And then I remember being in recess and I remember saying to my sister, or trying to, cancel my meetings till Wednesday. I'll be back on Thursday. And that mindset stayed until March. So it was only in March where I finally was able to go, yeah, you're not working for a little while. This isn't going to go away really quickly. And it took me that long to process, ah, shit, this is bad. This is a bad thing to happen. So yeah, was a real interesting thing. And what's also really interesting is I've started back at the gym this month. And I thought I was back to normal. I've been really lucky with my recovery. So obviously I can speak. Left side is back to normal. But I was at the gym and we were doing a particular movement. I got nothing. I can't do it. I cannot do that movement. And it's an isolated movement as opposed to a compound movement. But I was really shocked that there's still residual weakness there. And I, you know, 100 million times grateful because I there's many people with a stroke that are not where I am a year on, but I was still shocked to see there was still some residual stuff there. So that's how my year started, and then there was this downhill kind of roller coaster that I've been on and I'm hopefully now flattening out on.
So people always say we have to take one big learning, don't they, from these big life events, and I don't always know if that's true. But if I had to sum you up to someone, if I was describing you to someone, it would be Sarah's the person I know that had a stroke, and during the stroke she was cancelling her meetings just for the next 2 days. That would probably sum things up. Do you think it's made any of that change? Do you think you feel it's made you reflect on your work, or that cliched work-life balance thing?
Yeah, but not in the way that I thought it would. So I thought I'd have this epiphany and I'd be like, oh my God, work-life balance, completely revise all of my thinking. And that didn't happen. And I think it's because that all or nothing part of me, that go, 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 is so innate that I don't even realize it's happening often. So in the really obvious times I do, but otherwise I don't even realize that I'm still driving that. So I remember us meeting in May, I think, when I still wasn't right, and saying, right, this is the time to really go with CCC. And I remember you saying to me, oh, is it? Is it really? And I genuinely believed that was the way forward. And then I've done some really extra stuff. Like, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to go to Sri Lanka in the middle of a political downfall when the government says don't go. And I'm going to take my 3 children. And I'm going to go for 5 weeks, which I did. And it was fabulous. And I'm going to have an extension, which I did. And it hasn't been fabulous. So that that compulsion, I suppose, to go and do the big things didn't automatically change. And I thought something like a stroke would change it. But there's a much slower burn lesson, I feel, that I'm just getting now. And that is consistency over extreme. But it's literally conscious. I have to wake up and I have to go... Like this morning, I woke up and I was like, oh my God, how do I get my business from where it is to where I want it to be? Oh yeah, keep taking the small steps that I'm taking and it all adds up. With the extension, I wanted it all done and fixed by Christmas. It can't be. Small steps. And I just have to keep reminding myself, just do one thing today towards the ultimate goal and stop putting a time limit on the ultimate goal. So that, it's a lesson, but it's not been as wow, I now know and feel this lesson and can live my every life in this way. It's much slower and harder.
I think we've all fallen for that myth, though, haven't we, that everything is solvable, everything is, you know, we've just got to buy a solution and it fixes everything. And it's so much harder to accept that actually this thing is going to take me ages. It's not as shiny, it's not as sellable, is it? To say, I'm working on this project and guess what? I'm not going to be a millionaire by next week. I'm not going to get 4 dragons investing. It's going to take me a long time and I'm going to have to get there. But what about the other lessons that you take from it? Do you think it's made you more reflective as a person to think about your actions and how they impact on you or your well-being, or do you think that's asking too much?
No, but do you know what? I think it's made me more honest with those reflections. So I had a counselling session the other day, and it's more like life coaching, and it's with a lady called Henny Flynn, and it's really interesting. So I've always been very, very self-aware and self-analytical, so I'm always analysing stuff, but it's like I've been caught in my own box. So I can only analyse within the perspectives that I can see. And what I haven't been able to see, and I've been trying so damn hard, but what I haven't been able to see is the other perspectives available. So really stupid, but really interesting moment, right? On the back of my bedroom door are two Udis and a bag of lost socks. So always we have so many odd socks. That I put them in the bag of no love, and then occasionally I get the bag of no love out and I try to match socks up, and it's really great when they all match, but they never do. Anyway, it means that when I open my bedroom door, it often bounces back, and it's really annoying because I keep catching myself on the door handle. So occasionally I take the Udis off and I just leave them on the bed, and then it irritates me because they're on the bed and I want them to be in their home. So the other day, it didn't bounce back, but I could see the Udis were on the door. So I looked at the door and the bag of socks wasn't there. And I thought to myself, that was a really great thing. And I said to my husband, where's the socks? And he said, oh, I've moved them and put them in this place. And I thought, why did that never occur to me? Not once did it occur to me that you could move the socks and leave the Udis. And I know it's a really small thing, but it was like this like opening of another perspective. And that's what I think I'm always searching for, but you can only search for it when you've got some input from other people. And I've been quite reclusive in searching for it in you know, in terms of my own brain space. Does that make any sense?
It does, and I think it's something probably we're all getting more guilty of, because we surround ourselves with information and knowledge that matches our understanding of the world, so we become more entrenched. I was reading about an American psychologist recently who'd been criticised because they asked him what his 10 books beside his bed were. And one of them was a book that was quite right-wing. So people had said, oh, well, that must mean you're not actually got a more sensitive perspective, you're reading this right-wing book. And he said, but I'm reading it because I need to understand that perspective. But we've all, particularly as we get older, we do it anyway, but the internet and data allows us to really just do things that confirm what we believe and never challenge it. So the socks is really interesting, isn't it? Because that bag of muddled up socks is quite a good metaphor for you, believing that you've got to sort everything out. You need constant reminders that everything needs fixing, and it's your responsibility. And you can only rest soundly when all the socks are gone. But actually, I don't know a household that doesn't have a pile of, you know, unmatched socks somewhere in it. But it's very much that perspective, isn't it? Of Sarah has to fix it. Sarah's in the driving seat, and life will only be good when all the socks match.
Do you know, you're absolutely right. And one of the other things that I was talking to Henny about the weekend was my daughter. So I've got three kids. One of my daughters is so like me in so many ways. And we clash. And I'm aware of the perspective of, you know, it's usually what the thing that annoys you about another being is the mirror. I know that's a thing, but sometimes it's really hard to see the mirror because it's much easier to go, no, that's a problem and you need to change that because whatever. So one of the things that I did with Henny was we talked about a particular instance that really irritated me about my daughter and how it's a problem and how she's going to end up a delinquent teenager and la, 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 la. And so we talked a bit in detail about it. And what she was doing was holding the mirror up at me. And what she was saying is your body feels the shame and the embarrassment and the anger that you felt as a child when something similar happened, and your brain goes, oh, well, that's totally on you. Like, you did that and you need to change because that's not okay. But what she was saying is if you just take a minute and go, this isn't mine. This isn't me. It's okay. Breathe. Then you're much better able to look at, for example, my daughter, and for me to go, is that a problem? Is that unlikable behaviour that I don't like an issue? Or is it just her being her? And is that okay? So that's what I'm working on at the moment. And it's just having that moment where I realise this is mine and not yours. And at the same time, this is yours and not mine. So the feelings are mine and they're not attributable to you. So I'm just going to deal with that in me. Obviously, that's going to take me a whole load of practice because it's 39 years worth of, I hate that behaviour. But again, just a different perspective. And I love it.
I think, though, that perspective of, well, this is how I see the world, this is how it all makes sense, can be quite threatening, though, when someone asks us to challenge it. One of the things, I don't know if you've heard the expression ontological grief.
Say that again?
Ontological grief. So okay. The theory is we all have our own ontology, so we all see the world slightly differently. So in relationships, you know, one of our partners may feel that it's really, really important that the dishwasher is all stacked correctly, and the other one might think, well, you know, the cups are cleanish, it's okay. And that's our ontology. We see the world differently. We have different values, different perspectives. One of the things that's really troubling for people and a real red flag for what the next 12 months is going to be like is if the way they believe they were becomes threatened. So if somebody acts out of character in some way, then their whole world is shaken. So if somebody, I don't know, behaves in a way that they surprise themselves, so they do something, the extreme would be to do something criminal or to have an affair or something like that, then the impact of that on them as the individual quite often is that they suddenly realise that the perspective they had is completely wrong because the mirror that they held up to themselves was false. You know, I always thought I was this person, I would never be a person who. Well, actually, part of what I suspected might happen for you over the last 12 months was that image you had of yourself was going to be broken in some way because you didn't, in the life plan I've ever heard you talking about, I don't remember the 12 months being written in for the stroke. So that is definitely going to bring with it some form of grief, isn't it?
So here's a question for you. Have I, in fact, instead of challenging who I thought I was, I have looked for evidence to corroborate that I actually was that and it's not my fault that it's slightly changed. So, for example, if we use the affair story, I never thought I was a person that had an affair, but I wouldn't have done if you weren't at fault, if you weren't horrible, if you didn't push me towards it, will be a way to keep that self-image. I've had a stroke, not an affair, but my image of myself as... in fact, I said this to my husband the other day. I've always believed you can do anything you put your mind to. And I don't want to shake that belief. But I'm not really sure I can do that anymore.
I think that's right. So what we tend to do then is... You know, the affair is a good example. Rather than saying, oh, yes, I transgressed in some way, I did something that acted against the values I believed I had, what people tend to do then is they justify it. And they say, okay, well, actually, I had the affair because this person didn't do this, or actually, it was really hard for me, or, you know, poor me, and this is why I've gone down that route. But another dangerous thing is that if we're somebody who has high drive and we believe that we've really got to hyper perform, is there not a risk then that you say to yourself, well, actually the stroke is my fault as well,
and I've been down that road.
You know, but actually I believe that people have got to really work hard, and actually I worked so hard I had a stroke, so what do I need to do? I need to work really harder and learn not to do that. I need to work harder at not working harder. So actually nothing's changed, just you use some different words, and that's a real risk as well, isn't it? And actually, I'm a bit older than you, and part of getting into your 40s, I believe, is that acceptance that your ability to actually change the world and change your children and have this huge impact that you thought you were going to have is slightly less than we thought it was. Sometimes psychologists call it the smiley face. Have you heard that theory? So that in our 20s, we're really happy because we're up here and we think we've got the power to change the world and everything's new. We're doing new things, we're trying new things. And then we end up in our 30s where we believe that we've got to fix everything. We've got to be the best parent. We've got to have the biggest mortgage in the world. We've got to do all these things. But slowly as we come out of our 30s and into our 40s, we think, well, I'm all right. I'm accepting it. It's okay. And, you know, we're not really going to make this huge difference, but we're enjoying where we are. And I think maybe you've had an extreme smiley face where at the bottom of there you've thought, okay, things would need to change.
I'm wondering, as I'm listening to you, where I've gone, because I can see parts of it that could be a release on this massive, you know, goal that I need to achieve. So in line with the smiley face, and I can see parts of it that are diverted to whatever it might be, you know, from making my first million by the time I'm 40, which is now not going to happen, all of that kind of stuff. Maybe I'm just diverting. So my big thing now is I've put a lot of weight on last year. And I can't think that a stroke at 38, a heart operation at 38/9, and a whole load of stress is conducive to a long and healthy life when you add weight and unhealthy diet. And I drank too much last year. I ate crap, didn't exercise, blah, blah, blah. So my big thing now is I'm 40 in June and I've got to lose 3 stone. And how am I going to measure my mental health? And I've got like 25 apps that do the same thing. So have I just diverted? Or is there a bit of both? Is it not as black and white?
Well, I think first of all, you don't want to change completely, do you? Because then you're not Sarah anymore and you're somebody else. But also, there is about the first step of changing is recognising when you make the same mistakes. So is there something there about saying to yourself, well, actually, I was really, really driven before and I realised that didn't actually make me happy or potentially wasn't great for my well-being. But actually, I now just need to keep that in check and check that none of these things are actually ways of being really hard on myself. So you could look at the last year. Perspective's everything. I know someone called Sarah who had a stroke, has managed to keep her family together, has managed to keep her business alive, and is back on track. And now, on top of that, even a year on, she's already now to get on top of her health. That's a different perspective, isn't it? As opposed to, I let all these things go in the last 12 months. Where it's not that you just did things you needed to do to survive for 12 months. And now you're in a great place where you're ready to take a new thing.
I think that's really true. And I think what you've just said is really interesting. I didn't give myself any time just to survive. I literally thought I'd be back at work 3 days later. We lost quite a few clients. There was a whole mental breakdown, which actually probably hit October, November was when I was at my lowest. Mm-hmm. And I kept thinking, why? I'm 10 months post-stroke. That's ridiculous. Get your life together. I never gave myself any of that grieving time to go. And even now, like I'll be walking with my husband and I'll be like, did it really happen? Was that a thing? Because it's like that little tiny bit is just shut down. And it's not as bad as other people have it, so it can't really have been that bad.
I was just thinking as you said that, in my old offices when I was in Leeds, I saw a painting on the wall that a client did for me. And it said, Pollyanna, not welcome. And I don't know whether you know the story of Pollyanna. It's an old children's book about a little girl who was told that whatever you feel, there's always somebody worse off. So you might have a tummy ache today, but there's somebody with some terrible disease. You may break your arm, but don't be too sad because somebody could have broken two arms. And You know, there's always someone worse off. And I used to say to a particular client of mine, please can we drop this Pollyanna syndrome of always saying there's somebody worse off, because it doesn't, it's a way of minimising what we've experienced, isn't it, of saying, oh well, somebody else has been through that. And what perspective tends to do in time is that we minimise things anyway. So we say, yeah, that terrible thing happened, but you know, it wasn't, now when I think about it, it wasn't as bad as I think. And that's a good thing, because if we stayed in memories of pain and things, we'd never have more than one child, or you know, we'd never take a risk again, because we'd be trapped in the memory. But the danger of it is absolutely that we minimise what we've experienced. So you reach a point now, 12 months, where you think, yeah, the depression, it wasn't that bad really, was it? I was all right. I was probably poorly for a day. And you start to just minimise it and think, well, I'm not like these people who've been really poorly and their life's been impacted by a stroke. So you don't, you revert to who you were before really, really rapidly. But you forget that you are who you were before, but with this huge, effectively, trauma that you've got to give yourself some time to process.
Do you know what I'm still struggling with? And I find it really difficult to manage this, right? So if I go to the gym, I keep saying to myself, you don't need to mention the fact you had a stroke. You don't need to do that. And I always find I'll have a conversation with someone, and I'm not sure why. I don't know what the compulsion is. I don't know if it's because I don't think I'm going as hard as them and I need to explain why. I couldn't do the ski erg today. I need to explain why. So that's one issue. But another issue is, and I think they're very related, is I'm literally terrified. Literally, every time I get a headache, or I get, sometimes I still get pins and needles in my face, I'm like, shit, like, is it going to happen again? How do I know it won't happen again? Because they don't really know why I had it. So that's there daily, literally daily. And I have to kind of work through it and go. And the way I've tried to do it is to change the perspective. So I realized I had a core belief, which was, I am ill. I am poorly, I am not well. And what I try when I recognize that happening is to change it to going, I am getting better. Well done, I achieved this, I'm getting better, rather than I'm ill, I shouldn't have done that.
I think one of the hardest things though is to accept that bad stuff can happen. We tend, don't we, to think, well, it's not going to happen to me, or I won't think about it. I won't think about what I would do if that happens. And In a challenging way, you've opened the worst of Pandora's boxes, which says anything can happen at any time.
You believe that it was, and here's the crux, an uncontrollable event. If you believe that you lived your life too much, you were pushing too many boundaries, you weren't looking after your health, blah, 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 therefore it's my fault, then I still feel some control over it. And I'm really probably still in that category, so haven't made the switch that we were talking about earlier and hadn't realized that until this conversation. So I still feel that it was somehow my fault, that I could have done something better.
And I think this is something I talk about a lot to people, that what we have to accept, or what we've got to try and accept, is that anything can happen at any time. And that is the hardest perspective, isn't it?
But how do you take that from a logical concept? I could get hit by a bus tomorrow. I say that to my children many, many times. Like, to feeling it, to it being a go-to belief rather than a logical whip.
Well, for me, it's always been about accepting that, am I doing enough right now? Is what I'm doing right now good enough? Am I being a good enough parent? Am I being a good enough partner? Am I being a good enough business owner, mentor? All those different hats I might wear. And beyond that, there's not very much I can do. My children go off to school every day, and some days they have bad days, some days they have good. But unless they take me in their backpack, I haven't got much control over that. Life in general, you know, whether it be health, politics, all those things, are going to impact us. So all we can do is stay in the moment. And I think I've got quite a different perspective of this growing up. You know, my story, I grew up with brittle bones. So every day for me, there's always that thought, is today going to be the day I break a bone and something terrible happens? And as I get older, I see more of my peers have accidents that shorten their life or something like that. So it is a little voice in my head saying, oh, you know, that person was your age and they're not here anymore. But I think it's about the best thing we can do is not run away from that. It's just to say, yeah, it could happen. I accept it. The Stoics had a system where you should wake up every morning and just say, yeah, that might happen today. That might happen today. And then move on and accept it. And I do think there's something in that of just saying, yeah, bad stuff can happen. But I think at the moment, being in a position where you feel that you need to tell people about your stroke and things, that's not necessarily a bad thing. I think that just comes from a place of wanting to know you're safe. And, you know, actually, I'm going to the gym, I'm putting myself under a certain amount of pressure, and I just want to feel safe here. And actually, I think we all should do what makes us feel safe a bit more often.
I like that. I like that a lot. I'm interested in the theory of good enough, right? And my question to you highlights a significant issue. How do you objectively assess good enough? Because it's subjective, and I don't always trust my own subjective. So I need some external validation. Why and how do I assess good enough for me?
I think that is the $64,000 question, isn't it? And if everybody found that easy, we wouldn't be in a position where we bought branded goods and we use social media to give us that strange fuzzy feeling when somebody likes something we've posted or whatever it might be. We're all kind of search for that good enough thing. What I always suggest people doing though is saying to them, where is the bar? So before you go into a project or an experience, say, how would I know this was successful? What am I looking for to make it a good event? When I run events now, one of the things I try and do is before I run them, ask myself, what is it I want to get out of this? What would I like people to do at the end of the event? Whether it's, you know, come to another event, just tell me how great I am. Whatever the thing is, before I begin, I always ask myself, what is the measure I'm going to use of success? Or else if not, your measure tends to be comparison and disappointment.
I wonder if for me at the moment, because I am trying really hard to accept that there's still a long way to go with this, with the mental side of last year, because it wasn't just the stroke. The year started with a stroke and ended with a cowboy builder desecrating my home, which I'm still living in. It's not watertight. It's not structurally sound. It's very, very cold. And there was a heart operation in the middle. So the whole year was just shit. And I feel like what I need to do is in a morning, what will make this day good enough? And maybe that's what I'll start doing.
I think for me, that would be the perfect thing. What is it I really need to achieve today? What would be a bonus? And setting those mini targets. And the other thing I always recommend people do is just step back and think, what could go wrong today? Who might let me down? Who might disappoint me? What am I pitching for that might not come off? What might break or malfunction? Who might disagree with me or misunderstand me? And actually just going through the moment and saying, yeah, that could happen. And then moving forwards and saying, okay, but that's how I'll cope. Most days we're pleasantly surprised.
Mm. One of the things that I think is helpful and I'm getting much better at doing is just recognizing, like I didn't recognize before when I was thinking I was just going through a normal day, but I was just so full of anxiety, but it was the norm, so that the recognition of it was just an acceptance, whereas now I feel it And I'm like, whoa, what is going on with me? And often I don't know, but I do know that if I take the dog out for 45 minutes, that reduces. It might be back again half an hour later, but there's a little bit of respite. If I can just go, time out, get out into the air.
And there's a danger with that anxiety that we fall into something called rumination, where we feel the anxiety and then we sit down and say, well, what's wrong with my life? What's wrong? Well, this isn't great. This isn't good. I haven't done that yet. I promised myself I was going to be a millionaire by the time I'm 40. Look at me. And you start analysing. Then before you know who you are, you're remembering that you once upset a child when you were four and you cried at their birthday party. And all that comes crashing in. Where I would say to people, roll backwards and ask yourself, did I get enough sleep last night? Have I eaten correctly today? Have I spent some time with humans? Have I exercised? And check all those things are okay before you ruminate.
I like that.
If you start digging around in that bag of dirty socks, metaphorically, it's not all going to be good, is it?
Do you know what else has really helped me in the last week? Really, really helped me is, so when I'm feeling that, is just to go, the decisions I make today are right for me today. So I'll like get caught in a, oh, I should have gone to the gym and I haven't drunk 2 litres of water and I ate that cinnamon swirl that was on the side and I'm supposed to be calorie counting, blah, blah, blah. And then just to have a moment and go, the decisions I've made today are right for today. And being like literally saying that out to myself several times because it stops the shoulda, woulda, coulda. And I'm bad because.
There's that retrospective thing as well, isn't it? So sometimes, as parents, you'll say, oh, we should have done that. We should have, you know, picked this thing, or we should have taken them here. But what you've always got to go back to is, but when we were doing that, it felt like the right thing. We weren't acting out of malice. We weren't acting out of ill feeling. And the same, you know, whether it be a client who's disappointed with a piece of work we deliver, we probably know that we were doing our best at that moment. That perspective makes it a bit easier rather than saying, yes, well, now 12 months on with this great amount of hindsight, it was a great decision. It is a bit rubbish. I think the best thing you can do going forward is just checking in, am I all right at the moment? Is this all right? Yeah, it's okay. Yeah. That's a better perspective.
The inner voice. I like it. I like it very much. You know, this has been very cathartic, Stuart, because again, it's back to the perspective. Like, I, you know, I've gone in my own echo chamber for the last 12 months. Shoulda, woulda, coulda, my fault, shouldn't have done, try harder, be better, be less, be more, blah, 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 blah. So I found this really, really helpful. Thank you.
It's great to have you back.
It's great to be back in a slow and consistent and unextreme way.
Oh, no, that's what we'll keep an eye on.
Oh, thank you very much, Stuart.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. Your reviews, shares and followership is incredibly valuable to us. So please like and subscribe and share and get in touch if you have anything you want to chat about.